My name is Clancy Imelsland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really sorry we were late tonight. Somehow or other, I thought it was an 8 o'clock meeting, and we were late, and I'm sorry. It's Jack Peterson's fault. I haven't worked out why, but I will before the night's over. But I'm glad to be here this evening. I've had not that anybody cares, but I indulged myself today to do something I always wanted to do, to see these mining camps up in these Sierras. So this afternoon I started with Angel's camp and drove along and saw all the mining places and stopped and tried a little panning on the American River and got nothing and had a good trip and got here and feel good. Had a nice dinner with Zach and glad to be here tonight. The traditions traditionally are something that people kind of just, oh, not the traditions again. And tonight I was glad to see they read the long form of the traditions. We do that once a month in our group in Los Angeles, because it certainly has a dimension to it. But I think that if you look at them as, they really are interesting in a sense. In all of alcoholic history, there's only been two little groups have ever been of sober alcoholics who ever survived. And most everyone in the room knows about one of them because they're in one of them. The other one, of course, is in 1840, six guys got together in a bar in Baltimore. And one guy had just gotten out of jail. And he was telling his friends, they all say they know how I feel, but they don't know how I feel. Only you guys know how I feel. They say, oh, that's right. And so they got together and they decided, maybe we can help each other not drink. And let's form a club. We won't drink. And so they formed an organization. And, of course, they wanted a constitution. And they signed bylaws and made one guy president. And, of course, everybody laughed at these idiots. You know, drunkards can't keep themselves sober. They're going to keep each other sober. But they ran. They did for state sober for a little while. Pretty soon some other goof came by. And another goof. And pretty soon they had a few little people. And a guy from Philadelphia heard about it. And he started a little group up there. And pretty soon they started a group in Washington, D.C., and pretty soon they had a little group of drunkards helping drunkards. Nobody could understand how it could possibly work. And, we better get a name for ourselves. And they thought, nobody ever heard of drunkards helping drunkards, like nobody ever heard of a deal like America. So we'll name ourselves after America. We can't really do it after Americans. We'll call it after George Washington. So they became known as the Washingtonians. And at the end of the year, they had what appeared to be a number of hundred members, different places. Near the end of their second year, by this time they're getting pretty big, and they had some guys going, and they decided, since they got started in March, they'd use Washington's birthday, which is February 22nd, is their birthday. So they sent out a letter to all the people they could find, and said, on February 22nd, have someone from your city or community come in and give your group a talk. Not so much because we want to hear what they got to say, but they will see that we're not just a bunch of old drunkards anymore. We're sober people. So on February 22nd, 1842, all over the country, as far as they could, people came in Springfield, Illinois, for example. The young lawyer they got to come in and talk with was a guy named Abraham Lincoln. If you look at the book of Lincoln's speeches, it was a speech to the Washingtonians, February 22nd, 1842. And he was not a drinker, but he seemed to be quite sensitive to the idea. He said, I know you to be intelligent and sensitive people. And the only thing different between you and me, as far as I can tell, is that you have some kind of a thirst I don't have. And I don't understand why I don't have it. I don't understand why you do have it. But I hope that you'll continue. He gave a good talk. I have his talk on my wall, my office. And it continued to grow. And they got a couple of guys who were really good public speakers. Now, you got to remember what's so miraculous about this. There was no telephones, no radios, no newspapers to speak of. Just one-to-one, one-to-one, one-to-one. And they got a couple of good speakers who were out and speak at public occasions. But at the end of 5 years, it is estimated they had over 100,000 members, sober drunkards. And you think, well, that isn't such a big deal. It is when you stop and think, AA after 5 years didn't have 1,000. And they had newspaper articles and magazine articles and all sorts of things. And it really was a wonderful thing. And something about that time, they had a thought. And it seems unnatural, but it's the same thought you hear in AA today, so it isn't so unnatural. If we can help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people, not just drunkards. And so some of the people got involved in helping narcotics addicts who were not drunkards, people who, not heroin and cocaine like today, but the drugs of the kind, opium and such things. They got a group involved, a large group involved in stamping out the sale of alcohol, prohibition. That was long before we had American prohibition. And a lot of them got into they called the temperance movement. Some of them got active in trying to annex Texas, if that'd be good. And some got active in trying to work against slavery. And all these good people really worked hard, and they really went at it. And they put all their zeal to work. And by 1848, 3 years later, the Washingtonians were extinct, and nearly all of them died drunk on the street. I read a book written by one of these guys in 1861, and he can't understand what happened. He said, we were doing so well, and people seemed to lose interest in me, and people weren't interested in helping one another, and just couldn't understand. Okay, now you jump ahead 100 years. In 1940, early 1940, Alcoholics Anonymous is doing pretty good. They just got a play in the Saturday Post. They're doing good, but they're starting to crest. And now there's a lot of problems going on all over the United States. Wherever there's AA, there are fights and problems. And there's really a major problem between the two major wings of AA. New York, led by Bill Wilson. Akron, led by Dr. Bob. People in New York, not Bill Wilson, but his followers off, but these guys in Akron also caught up in that Oxford movement and all the four absolutes and all that religious crap. That's not for us. And the people in Akron, all these guys in New York, they've gotten away from the basic spiritual message of what we're trying to do. And all over the country, people chose up sides. In Los Angeles, for example, which was the only group in the West Coast at that time, they would have nothing to do with Akron. They only wrote to New York. But the people in Chicago would only communicate with Akron. They would not communicate with New York. And it was kind of funny, except people would get so upset they get drunk over it. And people get drunk over all sorts of things, and people fighting. And by the early in the mid-1940s, Alcoholics Anonymous had got to a point where more people were getting drunk than getting sober. And Bill Wilson would field these letters from all over and try to write answers. He just couldn't understand what was happening. It was dissolving in front of his eyes. And a guy in North Carolina wrote a little article for the Grapevine and sent him a letter saying, you know, we're going the way of the Washingtonians. And I'll tell you how extinct he had become. Bill Wilson had never heard of the Washingtonians. And he had to dig out some books on it and find a book on it. And he realized, my God, that's exactly what happened to them. They did well for a while, and then gradually they crested. And he said, what can I do? And he read about them, read their experiences, and read all these letters he was getting, and just crazy trying to find a way. And he finally sat down, and in desperation, as a last gasp effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, we all sat down while you read chapter 5. That's okay, I need a drink of water anyway. But in a last gasp effort to save Alcoholics Anonymous, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions. And he issued in the long form, as they were read tonight. And he issued them one at a time in this new little paper they had called the Grapevine. And all over the country. The main problem in AA then is the main problem in AA most of the time. It's full of alcoholics. So the people didn't want to accept the traditions. We got the steps. We don't need traditions. That's a bunch of crap. We don't need rules. And they fought about that. And for a couple of years, Bill Wilson traveled all over the country, came to Southern California, went to a lot of places on his motorcycle sometimes with his wife hanging on behind to try to explain to people these are not traditions. These are not rules. These are things trying to save us. We're going to become extinct. And he explained some people accepted it and some didn't. There's a lot of more back fighting. So he and Dr. Bob, who always stayed close, got together. And they said, we've got to somehow get all the people from everywhere, get them together, at least representatives, so they can see that we're all on the same track. They just don't understand that. So they assigned their followers, get us someplace to have a convention where we can get everybody together. And the people in New York said, well, we'll go to a convention, but we won't go to Akron. And the people in Akron, not to be outdone in spirituality, said, we'll go to a convention, but we won't go to New York. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and worked out a solution. Cleveland. Okay. So they all went to Cleveland. And on July 4th weekend, 1950, the first gathering of sober alcoholics, of large gatherings over in the history of the world, took place in Cleveland, Ohio. And that was a very touching affair. They have pictures of it. I have a picture of it shown from behind this hall. Nowhere, nothing like the size of now, but at least there is a hall full of people from all over. And there are tapes of it. I have a tape of that convention, and it's hard to understand. But that convention's hard, famous for one thing, among other things, is that's where Dr. Bob, this co-founder, gave his last talk. He is dying of cancer. And they said, are you sure you want to talk, Bob? He said, yes, I do. I want to convey, because I'm, you know, 15 years sober, except for Bill. I've been the most surviving man in the world, and I want to help these people. So they brought him to the podium, and most of us have either heard his talk or read it. If you haven't, it's a touching talk. He started off by saying, I'm so glad to have you here. And he said, I hope you all go back to your, tell the boys and girls back home what we're doing here and why we're here. He said, but I'd be indeed remiss if I didn't bring up two or three things that I thought might be of help to you. First of all, he said, let us remember, keep our program simple. Let us not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientists, but have nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, is love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. We don't need definitions. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and love and understanding. And there isn't anybody in AA who doesn't know what he means by that, because, boy, we are all, when we don't feel good, our tongue becomes a sword, just, and we cut up ourselves and cut others. And he said, finally, let us always remember to take the time to talk to the man behind us, maybe explain a little bit to him about AA and give him a pat on the back when he needs it, and take him to a few meetings, because none of us would be here if someone hadn't done it for us. And he said a few more things, and he sat down and he died a few months after that. But it was a great closing epiphany, I thought. But then another thing he did that convention, they took six young guys, six lively guys, they gave them each two traditions, and they got up and they tried to show these people that these are not rules, these are efforts to explain, they're just things to save our existence. And when you hear those tapes, they're kind of interesting. These young guys, they're trying to show this. But the people finally understood that. You know, one of the things they pointed out is that we don't even have any enforcement. You know, if you break the traditions, we have no way to enforce it. We don't make you stay home for meetings. Nothing. I think a lot of old-timers like me, kind of wish sometimes we had AA police, for example. Because, you know, cause I'm rather, I've been known as a dictator-type sponsor, and I try not to be, but I suppose I am. And people say, why does that guy dictate the newcomers? But what they don't realize is you must have the complete cooperation of the dictatee. Because all he has to say is, screw you, and the dictatorship is over. And I thought it'd be kind of nice if we had AA police could come at night and say, did you say screw you to your sponsor? Come with us. But they finally accepted the traditions in 1950 at that convention, and they were printed in the next printing of the book in 1951. We've got to remember that. Most people think that steps and traditions all just came out of the book sometime. They didn't. The traditions came much later based on all kinds of people like you and me getting drunk and dying. They are really based on something much more impressive than you can imagine. In fact, from the time they were condensed, they were first condensed to put them in condensing form. There's only one thing that's been changed in them. In the original condensation, the third tradition read, the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. And after it came out, they began to realize that's what old-timers have, is an honest desire. Newcomers never had an honest desire. You know, I have a desire to get that bitch off my back. I have a desire to save my job, maybe. And so they discussed that for a while, took out the word honest. So not just any kind of a desire to stop drinking. And that's the way it's been all these years. And so the tradition is pretty much self-explanatory. They were well read tonight by the young lady. But there's two or three things in the traditions I think we need to discuss, because the traditions are always under attack. They are always under attack by people who don't know the history of them and think they're the first ones who ever understood these other things. Probably the number one today is that third tradition. It says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And we get all kinds of strange people come to AA sometimes who are not alcoholics, say, I've got a desire to stop drinking and you can't keep me out. And what do you do then? They have got a desire to stop drinking. And it's a difficult thing, because sometimes you get all sorts of odd non-alcoholics in maybe, and actually driving out new people. That's one of the moments that you want to harken back to the third tradition in the long form, because it meant they read it entirely different. These were just abbreviations. The third form, the third tradition, as the long form starts off, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Alcoholics. They never dreamed when we wrote these traditions that someday non-alcoholics would be trying to sneak into AA. You can't get alcoholics in, but you get non-alcoholics in. Now, that's enough for you. And the reason for that is not because we consider ourselves above or below, but the thing that makes AA different, and that made the Washingtonians different, than any other therapy in the history of the treatment of alcoholics, these are the only two therapies that ever consisted of one drunkard talking to another drunkard. All other therapies deal with therapists or doctors or a clergyman or something, counselors, talking to drunkards. And here it's drunkards, and it's more than a coincidence that these are the only two successful therapies of all kind. Now, why would that be? Is there something mysterious about it? Not at all. There's nothing in AA, I don't suppose, that any of us haven't heard somewhere along the way. If you're looking for advice, I'm sure everyone in this room has got enough advice to last them for 5,000 years. Why would AA's advice be any better? Not because the information is necessarily better, but because eventually, hopefully by attending to AA, I get to little by little come to understand there are people here who know how I feel, who identify with it. Because all my life people have been saying, I know how you feel. And you say, no, you don't know how I feel, God damn it. You don't know how I feel. But around here, you stay here long enough, and one day some old fool comes over and says, I know how you feel. You think, my God, he does know how I feel. And that's the first rope across the chasm. And you get another rope, and a walkway, and then a road, and pretty soon an 8-lane superhighway. But it's all based on identification. Without identification, it's just information. I have been working with addicts now for 25 years, I guess off and on, in one form or another. And I think I probably know as much about addiction as most addicts, and certainly more than most counselors. But to this day, if I go to an AA meeting, and a guy gets up and talks about narcotics for an hour, that's interesting information. But it doesn't happen here. It's just information. That's not my problem. I never really understood that, except looking back, I can understand it one thing. About 1960, I was sober a couple of years, and I was kind of active and mouthy, and about a few blocks away from our club, they founded OA. Incidentally, all of these organizations have been founded. I knew all the founders of NA and GA and OA and CA. because they're all found in the same place. But the founders of OA came over, and she said, "We've got a little meeting going on called OA," and she said, "We've been running for a couple months, and I heard you talk on obsessions. The next time you come over and talk on obsessions in our OA meeting." I thought later, she never asked me to talk about curing obsessions, just obsessions, because that's what I knew about. So I went over and talked at this OA meeting. You know, it's the only one in the world, as far as I knew, about seven fat old ladies sitting around a table. And I told them about obsessions. I tried to be kind. And I got down. I sat down. And they had a little discussion about their problem. You know, they talked about the obsession. But one lady mentioned she'd eaten a whole chicken that morning. I thought, Jesus Christ. I was kind of sick. I didn't say anything. I'm too courteous. But some woman talked about eating ice cream and eating a half a gallon or a gallon or some amount. And I thought, wow, holy God. There's some sick cookies here, boy. I'll tell you. And some woman over here talked about eating until she couldn't eat anymore. She went and vomited, put her finger down her throat, and ate some more. And I thought, don't shake hands with me after the meeting. Jesus Christ. Yeah. I could see doing that for drinking, but not eating. But intellectually, I understood their problem. But I didn't understand it emotionally because it didn't do it for me what it did for them. And that's what makes AA so important. When I talk about what alcohol does for me to a new person, I hope he's saying, oh yeah. Because after that time, he thought it only did that for him and having these feelings. And that's the beginning of, that's why you have to be an alcoholic to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. And people do not seem to understand. They say, oh, you think you're too good. No, that's not at all. That's why a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who also had a narcotic problem, started Narcotics Anonymous. So that narcotics addicts who were not alcoholics would have a place to go and identify. And that's why a member of AA started OA. And two guys in AA started CA, Cocaine Anonymous. And a guy I know well, Jim Willis, founded GA. His is an interesting story. He was married to Sybil Willis, Sybil Corwin, who had the most sobriety of anybody in the world before she died. But he started GA in the late 1950s, and it thrived. God, it's really successful in many areas where there's gamblers. And he is revered in GA like Bill Wilson is in OA. I mean, in AA. Well, but he got so busy in GA, he didn't have time to go to AA anymore. And he got drunk and died drunk. But he is still revered in GA because he showed them how they could live without gambling. And that's exactly, because that's what it is. And he forgot he was an alcoholic because he's so active in GA. But that's why the third tradition is there. It's not to be different or be above anybody or below anybody. But you must be an alcoholic. Without that, it's just pointless. It's just information. Pretty soon it gets dull. Meetings all over the country have had infestations of non-alcoholics. And they sit there and they kind of take over the meeting. Then they get bored by it after a while and they leave and the meeting is ruined. And that's why it's especially necessary when there's a closed meeting. Closed means closed to alcoholics only. And it's too bad that sometimes we have to say to somebody, well, I'm not an alcoholic. You must leave. We care for you, but you must leave. And people say, oh, I don't want to make trouble like that. But you must. That's what AA is about. Without identification, you got nothing. In a closed meeting, an alcoholic should be able to talk about anything. That's what's wrong about trying to do a great deal of sharing in an open meeting where they invite everybody in. I don't want to share in front of people who don't understand me. They think I'm some kind of a crazy bastard or something. You know, really. And I certainly don't want to talk about some of my secrets to people who will not understand what I'm talking about and they'll think I'm crazy or something. So I'll just say the nice little things and go about my business. The third tradition is most important. And the fifth tradition goes on to the same thing. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Not to the person who still suffers, not to the neurotic who still suffers, not to the addict who still suffers, to the alcoholic. Now, of course, you got to remember, as long as you're an alcoholic, you can be anything else. You can be an alcoholic and an addict, and an overeater, and a cocaine, anything, you know, as long as the alcoholic is in place. And that's also why, because it's so hard for us to overcome our feelings of difference. That is why people like us must try to remember, I think, in my opinion. Everything I say is my opinion. I'm required by law to say that. I may secretly feel I'm speaking for Bill Wilson in heaven, but I'm not allowed to say that. But that's why when you speak a day, you should say, my name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Not a Jim and a. I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic, and an addict, and a gambler, and a, we don't care. It has nothing to do with us. When you say you're an alcoholic, you're telling us you have an addictive personality. And that you may have these other things too, and if you have other problems, you better go to this. You go to NA, and they don't want to hear about your drinking problems. You go to CA, they don't want to hear about your drinking problems. Go to OA, who wants to hear about drinking problems? And in A, I don't want to hear about their problems. This is about identification. The most glib guy can get up there in the world and talk about all the things he does, and, you know, it's just information. And some silly bastard for the second meeting might get up there and say, I don't know how to explain it, but when I drank, it made me feel all different, and I felt better, and I felt like I was something, and that got me in deep trouble. And everybody in the room says, yeah, we know that feeling, baby. You know, that's what it's about. The other thing that occasionally comes under attack is this idea of money. And it's an amazing thing. It's too bad. I'm not trying to preach to you, because when you preach to a group, in a group like this, you're talking to the, it's like ministers talking to the choir, as they say. You're talking to the people who are active. The people who don't do it are the ones who are not here. But, you know, such things as making sure your group contributes to the central office in New York and so on. And so many groups don't even have a representative, don't care. We don't give a shit for the inner group. And all they do is fragging, they wonder why the group has no esprit de corps. We don't have to take money, but we give a little money to New York. We give it to our inner group. We give them some degree of respect. We have some kind of intermingling. It's interesting thinking about that convention where they got, for first, they could get some people together, and it was so successful they decided to do it again one more time. So they did it in 1955 in St. Louis. And then it got so good, they decided to do it one more time in Long Beach. Well, let me tell you a little success story about that. I was about 2 years sober, as I said, about a year and a half then. I still didn't have any front teeth. I wasn't doing very well, but I was working. And my sponsor said, I want you to go to that international convention. I thought, oh, shit. I've been slipping in AA for almost 10 years. I know some of these people down there will be people I used to grind, and he'll say, oh, here's Mr. Smartmouth now, who they kick out your teeth, did they? Nice and bad clothes. And he said, I'm not going to debate with, just go down there. So I went down there, and they're much smaller than our numbers. It's held at the Long Beach Football Stadium, and there's an exit over there where the decent people from all around the country are waiting to come in with their shiny suits and their dresses. Around the corner, there's another entrance where the drones and the shirkers and the misfits all stood. And they weren't organized the way they are now. And some guy came on and says, we need some ushers. We really need some ushers. And none of the nice people wanted to usher. They were there in their good... So they brought us in, few of us, they gave us a purple armband that said Usher. And they said, we want you to do now is look for handicapped people or elderly people and show them to a seat. Yeah. All right. So I snatched off the first old lady coming in. I took her down to the front row, center, sat her down, took off my badge, my armband, sat next to her, and had a wonderful seat for the whole convention meeting. It was a great meeting. That was maybe one of the world's best meetings. Bill introduced Ebby, who later talked, gave the only talk ever, gave more time he ever sober long to talk at the convention. Introduced Sister Ignatia. I was about as far as I am from Jack here, from Bill. And Bill Wilson told his story. And just talking about living history, just, oh. It turned my whole life around for about a week. I went back to being upset again. But boy, there's something. But these international conventions run every 5 years. And if you ever get a chance, I hope you go to them, because you sit in a room with people from all over the world. They're all excited. They're all up. And they're so glad to be sober. And it kind of keeps you from being jaded because you've been sober a little while. It's a great experience. The last area that's under attack a little bit, of course, is anonymity. And that's always been under attack because people say, gee, it would do so much good if people realized that we had such great people in AA. We talked about that at dinner tonight. Some old-timers even thought that. Bill Wilson once upon a time thought that before he wrote the traditions. But, I mean, he went on tour. And he had his face in the paper, founder of AA visits. And he realized it made him feel very uncomfortable, so he stopped doing it. But I'm in my day, since I've been sober, I've seen around Los Angeles, seen great famous people become sober. Lillian Roth, who wrote I'll Cry Tomorrow and had a movie made about her. She put it in her book, I'm a member of AA now. And people say, you shouldn't do that. I'm going to help AA by doing it. I'm going to help membership. And a couple years later, she was drunk, laying face down in Palm Springs and vomiting her pills up. I don't know how much she helped AA then, but she didn't hurt AA. You don't hurt AA by doing that. Diana Barrymore, I remember her when she's coming to a couple of meetings and she wrote this book, Too Much Too Soon. And she was the daughter of John Barrymore. She talked about in her book about how she went to AA and the AA ladies helped her, and it really helped her a lot. And she has a little wine with dinner now, but she watches it very carefully. But she went down drunk and died drunk. And this goes on and on and on. I've never known anyone who's ever broken their anonymity who profited from it. Say, but maybe they're doing it for the good of AA. But AA doesn't need that kind of good. AA doesn't need that help. The purpose that anonymity is valuable, at least in my readings of Bill Wilson's writings, it isn't to protect. Maybe at one time in 1940, it protected people in AA, but not anymore. It now we've come to understand has a different meaning entirely. It is to protect me. Because somehow when I get into a position where I think I'm helping AA by saying I'm in it, AA can no longer help me. I'm now above it and different. There's a spiritual value here of surrendering your ego to anonymity. And I'll tell you, because of the nature of my work, I've had about 7 or 8 big articles about me in the Los Angeles Times and other papers. I had a 6-page article in the Reader's Digest. I'm on television all the time. They're interviewing me all the time. And never once have I ever broken my anonymity. Not because I'm wonderful, it's just I'm very superstitious. So when I see these people say, oh, they broke my anonymity, it wasn't my fault. They will never break your anonymity if they ask them not to. And people who break their anonymity always wind up in a worse state. I don't know why that is. Maybe it's just magic, but I'll tell you that. It is not necessary to break anonymity. Now, let me explain what anonymity is. You can say that you're a recovering alcoholic, but you can have your face, you can use your name. My name is Clancy Immelman, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. And I put that on television. But I can never say I'm a member of AA, that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I speak as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I have to be anonymous. And if I'm on television, usually they just use a profile, a cutout, or a shadow. And they use a different name. Because I must maintain anonymity here because the sum of the whole is greater than Clancy Emerson by millions of degrees. And when I start putting myself thinking, I'm helping AA by telling people I'm in it, I'm in deep trouble. And I've lost a great part of the spiritual cornerstone of this movement. So really, that's why we maintain anonymity. It isn't because we're trying to protect AA. We're trying to protect the individual whose anonymity is being protected. That's why. And that's why so many of these actors in Hollywood just cannot stay sober. They just can't wait to get on some talk show. It's MNAA. That's the last year of them until the next time they come out of the treatment center. And again and again and again. There's about three actors that I know in all of Hollywood who are good AAs. I got a great insight into this when I was about 3 years sober. Very famous actor at that time who just died recently. But he had a meeting in his garage. All actors, special meeting of all actors. Had it for years. And he had to have an invitation to get to it. Jeez, I wanted to get to it. I'm from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I want to see movie stars. And I sucked around people I just hated. And just, hi, how are you? How you doing? Good looking suit. Except I didn't do that. So finally I got an invitation when I was about 2.5 years sober to go to this. And I was just sick with excitement. And the guy took me and we went into the meeting. And we sat in the meeting upstairs in this garage. The garage was like most people's posh house, just hot and cold running doorknobs, just fancy, you know. And sat around and there they were, all those actors that I'd seen for years, one after another. And they went around the room and talked. And I just, oh. They got back to me and I felt sheepish. But on the way home, I suddenly realized they'd all been in that room off and on for 6-7 years. They were very famous, that meeting. But I had the most sobriety in the room. I had 2.5 years, and that's more than anybody else had by far. Because they all understood why each other slipped. That's the other reason why we talk about special interest groups. Because that great feeling of difference. When you go get together with other people just like yourself, you all identify, yes, we are all different. We're different from them. That's why groups of doctors work for a little while, but eventually you have to get out of the AA and lawyers and all the pilots and all these other things. Special interest groups. We have to somehow break down the walls that make us feel we're so different. And we have to maintain our anonymity. And if you don't maintain that, your life is not anywhere near what you want to be anyway. So I think it's kind of an interesting thing that we should all be living rather well. The good groups today are the groups who preserve the traditions, I think. The groups who don't preserve the traditions may think they're free, but pretty soon they're... I'll tell you a little phrase. A group where anything goes is eventually a group where nobody goes. Because there's a certain inherent need for the structure of AA in all of us, I believe. And so those are the traditions that keep us together. And I'm very glad we got them. And that's all I have to say on that subject. Okay. These questions must have been written before I talked because you couldn't possibly need any more information afterwards. Please explain anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions. This is like David Letterman. All he needs is some glass breaking as I let him go. Can a non-alcoholic be an AA member based on the premise you are an AA member when you say you are? No. In fact, I wish I had it. I usually carry my wallet. I don't have my wallet. There's a folder called, it's this, called about, more about, what's it about? Anyway, there's a series of questions and answers by Bill Wilson. And it specifically says, can a non-alcoholic be a member of AA? And the answer, he says, no. Should we allow people to think they are? No. I mean, clearly and specifically, what's in that folder, little folder? You know what it is, Jack? More about, is it more about alcoholism? No. Problems other than alcohol. Shut up, Jack. That's the way it is in AA. You extend a hand of help and some guy bites it. Anyway. All right. There is a 12-step in-house recovery program in our hometown. It wishes an AA group representing H&I committee to come in once a week. They want us to sign a form stating we will not repeat anyone's names after leaving.
which is what we should be practicing anyway. Is this a conflict with tradition? Apparently, the 12-step house wants people to come in, put on a meeting, and leave, and sign a slip saying you will not repeat anybody's name you saw in there. I've never heard of that, but I can understand the reason why. If people have been going in there and saying, you know who's in the recovery house now? Because as it's been said, that's the way AA should be anyway. We shouldn't be talking about who's in meetings anyway. I don't see any conflict with the tradition as such, I don't think. Is chanting principles before personality at the end of the reading of the 12 traditions breaking the traditions? No, it's just stupid. You are maybe very fortunate to know exactly where that custom started. Would you like to know?
Yes.
For a dollar. About 32 years ago in the San Fernando Valley, an old guy named Bill W., not Bill Wilson, was a kind of a crazed old eccentric. He had very strong opinions. One of them was that everybody should remain anonymous in AA, not just anonymous at the level of press, radio, and film, but anonymous from each other. You know, my name is Fred. Call me sometime. I'm in the book. You know. And what he would do when they read the traditions, in order to, sometimes he'd whisper along with them, principles before personalities. You hear that? And they'd say, oh, for Christ's sake, Bill, shut up. Say, won't shut up. Needs to be said. So after a while, three or four young guys, one of whom I knew, start mocking Bill. And he'd say, principle before personality. And they'd say, principle before personality. Is that right, Bill? He said, shut up. Not going to shut up. You know. And this went on for a while. And then somebody from the Sylvan Cedros group came over there to talk one night and heard this and thought of some sort of a spiritual breakthrough. Took it back to the Sylvan Cedros group. And for about 20 years, there were four groups in the central San Fernando Valley where they chanted principally four personalities. None of them ever knew why. You know, just principally four personalities. And we'd go out there to speak, we'd have to laugh. We'd go out to speak at the chanters meeting or the Greek chorus meeting, you know. And then somehow the cork got out of the bottle. And the bacteria got in the wind somehow. And then there's usually a group of defiant people who carry that. The same people who interrupt chapter 5 to say, what's the point? The point is get your ass out of here, you know. But. So now you go to a lot of places. Not only do they chant at the end of the 12 traditions, they do it at the end of the 12 steps, you know.
That God could and would have saw.
They do it at the end of the promises. They knew what they were, you know. But it has no meaning. And here's the funny thing. The Sylvan Cedros meeting and the Canoga Park meeting where it started, now the secretaries do the same thing your secretary did tonight. Ask them not to chant. But so it means nothing. And you may not be able to change people's minds. You've been sober a long time, like 6 months. But work on the newcomer. New guy back there, where'd he go? Don't chant. Or we'll come and get you. I hope I didn't seem too forceful. My home group, 1,100 people every Wednesday night. And you, if any, not a whisper. Not a whisper. That's great. Is chanting principles before personalities breaking the traditions? What does Clancy I from out of the sky really mean? I'll tell you where that phrase comes from. I'm sure I'm a little warm up here. I use it to describe a particular action I have. That's where I came from. In our home group, we have 1,100 people. I started that meeting many years ago with 8, 9 people. And I got up to 12 people. Then I got up to 15 people. Then I offended some people. And I got back to 9 people. At the end of the year, we had about 35 people coming. And I thought, God, I could have an election now, but that really would be doing these people a disservice. You know, they would be leaderless. They're not fit to lead themselves, really. So I sacrificed myself and didn't have an election. So about a year later, about time for another election, we had about 60 or 70 people coming. And I thought, God, they're like an emerging third world nation. They're so close to self-government, but they're not quite ready. I'll sacrifice myself and just keep being secretary. And after about 2 months of this, something came up to me, some guy whose life I'd saved. He said,
are we ever going to have an election around here? Why, aren't we doing it right? Aren't you just working?
No, that's not the point. But people in other groups say that we never have an election, and if we had an election, we could vote you in, and then nobody could say a word. Good idea, Jimmy. So we had the election, and they swept me out of office. And to show you what a good job I'd done, though, even after I left, the group really took off. Now it's about 1,100 people every Wednesday night, largest meeting in the world by far. And I'm not the secretary. I don't care. But I'm the founder. I sit in the middle every Wednesday night and I give little signals. Nobody pays any attention, but it cheers me up, you know. Now, I speak over the last few years because I've been active. I speak all over the world. I've always got an airplane on the weekends. It's kind of a local trip today. A couple weeks ago, I was in New Zealand. Soon I'll be in North, South Africa and so on. So I'm on airplanes a lot, and so people know them. But after the meeting, I stand in the back, and I try to look like a founder. And people bring newcomers up here. This is Clancy. He travels all over the world. He's going to be sober 40 years pretty soon. And he flies all over the world and helps people. And he founded this group. Hello, newcomer. Glad to have you here. I hope you brought your problems. Many folks leave them here. There's something equally inspiring. Once in a while, some boob will come up who doesn't know who I am.
Hey, buddy, can you give me a ride back over to the VA psycho ward?
And I use that as an example of what AA is about. The nice thing about AA, I learned this when I was new. You can think whatever you want it. I can look right into his sick little eyes and say, think. What? Give you a ride back to the VA psycho ward, you psycho puke? There are 1,100 people in this room who need action. There's one who's been giving all year after year after year. I'm not just a good-looking guy in a suit back here. I'm Clancy I from up in the sky, bringing AA all over the world. Now, the nice thing about AA is you can think that as long as you say, okay. And the miracle of AA is after you drop this puke off with this VA, as you drive home, my head says, oh, Clancy, is there no end to your goodness? That's where the term Clancy I from up in the sky came from. Have many groups lost sight of their primary purpose, in your opinion? Yes, I think they have, unfortunately. And I think they pay a terrible price for it. They lose their sobriety, they lose their entity as a group, and they wind up... The largest group in Manhattan was the Midtown group. For years, I spoke there a couple, two or three times over the years. And they got a new steering committee that, all this, I mean, you don't have to... It's all one disease. It's all one disease. Narcotics, alcohol. Of course, if I'd have been there, I'd have told them the facts of life. Do you know where the phrase is? It's all one big disease. Where that comes from? It comes from a treatment center that only had one van.
Send them all to AA. It's probably all one big disease. Shit, we can.
And little by little, they're more into NA than AA. Last time I spoke there was a bunch of NA announcements, and hardly any AA announcements, and people, entirely different class of people seem to be. And the next time I went back there, they were extinct. The largest group in New York was gone. Just gone. Because that's what happens. If you lose the AA connection, eventually, unless an AA group is helping alcoholics, it'll disappear. It'll become nothing. And there's a lot of groups. You can look at an old meeting list and look at the... Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, I remember that group used to be there. Where did the phrase, I am responsible for anyone anytime come from? It causes more controversy to our fellowship than anything else. What is the true meaning of that writing?
That comes from that was the theme introduced at the International Convention in Toronto in 1965. It's introduced by Bill Wilson. And I've never been a great fan of it, but I know what it means. It means I want to do whatever I can to make sure wherever anybody needs help, that AA continues to flourish. Now, I obviously can't be at all these places, but I can support AA and support the World Service Office and keep our intergroup going so it does happen. My sponsor, Chuck Chamberlain, was not a fan of that either. He didn't like it, but some people don't like it. It never has struck me. But what they mean, it just really is that I want AA to be present, and we all want AA to be present for anybody who needs it. Do you think more about that, Jack? You know anything more about that? What? Oh, I know Chuck wouldn't. No, I don't mean that. I mean any reason why they would accept that. Well, that's about it. Here's okay. Huh? Yeah. Well, I know, but I believe they meant alcoholics. I know, but they didn't say it, so we argue about it. How many? Right after we determine how many angels can. By the way, bring back that book. We just lent it to you. Just for the photographers. Now, here's a bad one. I really shouldn't even read this, but I can't help myself. For the Democrats among us define sexual relationships. Well, let me put it this way. If you are expecting a good answer to that, you're screwed. Did you write the new pair of glasses for Chuck Chamberlain from the tapes he made? No, I did not write. I wrote the preface to it and signed by me, Clancy I, 1983. But those were a series of tapes, and some old line AAs and editors took the tapes and edited them, so because spoken language is never like written language. If the sentence is not completed, no punctuation and so on. That was done by some very good AA members, and they made this into a book form, which, while not AA literature, I consider to be one of the great AA help books of all time. And they asked me to write the preface for it because I'd been a sponsor for, he'd been my sponsor for many years, And here's the interesting thing. There's also an introduction written by a guy from Sacramento. You remember that, Jack? Huh? Every time I look, blink your eyes if you hear me at all, Jack. Jesus. I'm sorry I bought you that ice cream cone now. But anyway, there's a guy from Sacramento, who wrote the introduction. He talked about how he'd been slipping and how Chuck Chamberlain helped him. And when the book came out, shortly after, he got drunk and died drunk. So, you know, who can tell unless you're doing it? Okay? Frank Austin really doesn't really have a desire to stop drinking. Is he still a member? I don't know who Frank Austin is, but I would say if you could be a member, everybody's a member who wants to be. If you don't have a desire to drink, why would anybody want to even come? I don't know what they want to come for. Huh? Who's me? Oh, you're Frank and I'm Ernest. Well, that's the sort of interesting question that some idiot writes. Why the change from employ social workers to employ special workers? I never knew it was social workers. I never knew it never was. It never was social workers. And what made you think it was a change? It's always been special workers in traditions, as far as I know, at least since I've been sober. I've never said social workers. Do you consider television commercials and alcohol on Alcoholics Anonymous to violate the 11th tradition as promotional? Not really. I don't really think so. I think if they're done well, if they're done with anonymity and done everything, and they're not. All they're doing is letting people know it exists and how to reach them. Because, you know, it's amazing. We know all about AA, but most people know about as much AA as we know about Scientology.
We know it's there, but I want to be. How would you get to be in Scientology? I don't know. And sometimes when you're sick, and there's been a number of cases of people in AA that I've heard who have come to AA as a result of being sick and hungover and seeing that phone number up there and calling it. And I don't think we're trying to really promote AA. We're just letting people know it exists. If it's done with a lot of fanfare and blazingness and bizarre behavior and so on, I think that's a bad thing to do. But I think just the fact that here we are, if you ever need us, and if you're sick, you need you. And I think it doesn't bother me at any rate. Please tell us why a group treasurer should never juggle the seventh tradition, as in mixing it with H&I's money. Well, for one thing, because H&I is not AA, H&I is not part of AA. A group is a group. It's an entity in itself. A group, when you contribute to a group, don't be afraid. When I donate to a group, I think I'm giving it to AA and to God. And I don't want the group to spend that money for anything else. I don't want it to spend it to send flowers to some sick member. I don't want it to put on a party for somebody. If you want to do those things, have a special collection for them. But the AA collection is for AA, period. Not for H&I, not for anything else. It's for the AA meaning, in my opinion. And I think of H&I and other things like it. H&I is a good work and people get active. And in fact, I met Patty Knox at the Vacaville Penitentiary, where she was doing time as a hostess. That must have been hard on you with all those guys. Well, but anyway, that's wonderful. I've been going to institutions for years, but it has nothing to do with the AA group. The AA group is an AA entity. Alcoholics Anonymous, the fourth. Every group is an individual entity, that tradition say. And I think that's why you cannot juggle, cannot mix AA's money with anything else. It's AA's money. If you got some money, you send it to New York, you send your intergroup office, you pay your rent, you have a prudent reserve, you buy your coffee. Anything beyond that is just BS, because that's just not what AA is about. Why is structure so important? Well, I suppose to define structure would be to say, to me, what I consider to be an example of structure, not talking about the philosophy of it, but the structure of it, that structure has kept the Catholic Church going for 2,000 years. I'm not a Catholic, and I'm never go to the Catholic Church. But I also know that I have people in my family who go to the Catholic Church. And I go there with them sometimes. And I don't, you know, I've known nuns has hit me on knuckles with a ruler. I didn't go to Catholic school. I don't know about all that stuff. I'm just saying the structure of the church is when you go to church, you know what you're going to find there. You're going to do your thing and you're going to go home again. And you're going to do your duties and your annual duties and your Thanksgiving or Christmas duties and your Easter duties and all these things. Structure is, here's what I think about structure. In my opinion, I've told a lot of people this. If you have a meeting, a speaker's meeting, say, for example, several things you can do. Have good coffee and have it in advance. Not somebody come at the last minute and say, oh, I didn't get it ready. Start on time. Have as good as AA as you can to speak. Have it run on a regular basis. So every time they go there, they know they're going to be on time. There's going to be a cup of coffee. There's going to be a good speaker. And we're going to be surrounded by AA members. And I've watched so many groups like this start. We started one in Auckland, New Zealand a few years ago. The Pacific group. And of course, when they first started, we said, oh, you're a bunch of goddamn Nazis. That's what you are, a bunch of goddamn Nazis. They do it all over the world. But it's now the largest meeting in Auckland. The largest meeting in Tacoma, Washington is the North Pacific group, using the same format that we use, that you use here. The largest meeting in Minneapolis is the Central Pacific Group with structure. The largest meeting in Charlotte, North Carolina is the South Pacific Group. The largest and most successful meeting in New York is the Atlantic Group. The largest and most successful meeting in Fort Worth is the Fort Worth Pacific Group. The largest meeting in Southern California next to south of Los Angeles is the Oceanside Group. Done the same thing. I think that all of us, we want... We want freedom and we want not to be bound by any trammels. But deep inside of us, there's a certain puritanical need for structure and things to be right and organized. Because they all say about alcoholics, they are perfectionists. I either want it right or I'm not going to do it at all. Screw it. And so we can't always do that, but we can make it right. I think, to me, structure is so important that you have a, if you have a discussion meeting, that you follow the rules of the discussion meeting. Not everybody just chime in and wants to get up and wander around and talk and act like assholes. Do as you sit down and conduct a meeting. Whenever I speak, it happened again last night, people come to you to shake hands, say thanks. And nice, some of them, but I also, a lot of guys wear caps. Some guys wear caps. And I was taking, I said, just a second, I'll talk to this man. And I take him over to the side, not to embarrass him. I said, I'm going to tell you something my sponsor told me 40 years ago. Don't wear your cap at an AA meeting. You know, or, yeah, take off your hat. That's a boy. don't wear your cap at AA meeting. Well, why not? That's doing, it isn't that. It just shows a lack of respect. I know you don't feel that, or else you wouldn't be here. But it looks as though you don't give a shit. If I were going to your house for dinner tomorrow night, I'd take off my cap and you'd want me to. And this is more important than going to your house for dinner. I mean, just little things like that. Structure. Just treat AA with respect, and it gives you a lot better chance to survive, in my opinion. Should a group use some of the tradition money for birthday chips which are not AA? Well, I would think that is a matter for the group conscience. Now, that's something the group conscience can determine. If the birthday chips are being given inside the group to members of the group, I don't think that's mixing up the funds. Certainly, you're buying some things, but you can always say, I'm buying a birthday cake from a... The birthday cake isn't AA either. As long as you're celebrating sobriety, I wouldn't have any trouble with it. Maybe some people would. I would, as long as it's within that group and the money's staying within that group to do what's right for that group. Where does keep coming back, it works, is it considered chanting? I don't know where it came from. Do you know Jack? He doesn't know. I'm going to stop. I'm going to talk over. Do you know? If Patty doesn't know, nobody knows. I don't know where it comes from. It's like chanting, except it's not interrupting the reading of our basic text. Keep coming back. What's the difference? Who cares? I remember when it used to be people fought against saying the Lord's Prayer. In much of the world, they still won't say the Lord's Prayer. They say the Serenity Prayer. And I always say the Lord's Prayer so they can hear me while they're saying the Serenity Prayer. What are characteristics of the alcoholic personality based on your personal experience? Well, in my personal experience, immaturity. I would say most of it. All kidding aside, I think a case can be made for the idea that your emotional growth slows down or stops when alcohol begins to work for you, because you no longer have to deal with the problems of living. You could put them aside or change them, and you have to pay a terrible tab for it. But I know that when I got sober, in many ways, I was like 14 or 15 years old. Because the sad thing is, you wind up with grown-up brains and grown-up bodies and grown-up mouths and grown-up slickness, but all of the intermittent beck and call of childish emotions, hurt feelings and sudden rages and feelings of rejection. And I think that's why they have newcomers not get involved in relationships if you can in the first year, because they get drunk, or they have no, they're like teenagers, just... And I mean, it's kind of funny, except some of them die as a result of it. I think that the characteristics, and I look at my life. When I was about 12, my parents were divorced, and I was living in a society, now believe this, where I'd never heard of a divorce. Can you believe that? In such a religious community in northern Wisconsin, strong church, strong family. But even so, I almost immediately began doing this most terrible thing. I began playing my mother against my father to avoid discipline and responsibility. And as a result of that, I went from being, when I was 12, I had been shoved ahead in school a year. I was smart. I was a straight-A student. I've outsmarted my mother and father and all these people for 3 years, got rid of all that damn structure. At 15, I was flunking out of high school and hitchhiked and ran away from home and joined the Merchant Marine and sailed out of San Francisco. My life was all changed. Because I, And I look back now, and I'll tell you this. I was learning things at in my 50s I should have learned when I was 13 and 14. I think about emotional reactions and things. So I think that, they say about alcoholic emotions. I don't think there are such a thing as alcoholic emotions. When I get angry as an alcoholic, I'm angry just the same way that Pharaoh got angry at Moses when the rivers ran red with blood. God damn you! You know. But I think I have a tendency as an alcoholic. What I have to learn here is ways to control those emotions, to not act on them until finally they diminish a little bit. In our primary purpose, how must we use or not use anonymity? Do we use our full names or not? That's up to you. In an AA meeting, I always do. Dr. Bob always said maintaining anonymity within a meeting is as bad as breaking it outside of the meeting. I'm not trying to hide myself from you. Trying to not use it as a term, a way of personal self-aggrandizement in the world. That's all. I don't see any reason. As I said, the illustration I used a little earlier, you know, get to the point where, give me a call if you want to. My name is Jim. Jim what? I can't tell you that. Just look in the book for anybody named Jim. Not really accurate. A crazed person tells an AA member that if he, the member, does not drink a bottle of booze he hands him, he will shoot him dead. What should the member do? Stay away from the guy who wrote this. Because he's cuckoo. That is interesting. What would you do? Well, I'd send him out for some mix and maybe I'd make my getaway. Is passing a second collection basket for special events in such an anniversary zone against traditions? No, that's fine. That's fine as long as you're doing it, passing a basket. People know what it's for. They know they're not going to do it. You have to put it in. If I don't approve of the thing, I don't put any money in it. You know, that's fine. I don't see anything wrong with that. As long as the basic basket goes to the group. And here's probably the most important one of all tonight. And it's one I have no answer for. Did you know the meeting ends at 9 o'clock? I do now. Thank you very much.